Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Hey everybody, a great one for a change, and this time I mean it. You gotta listen to this one because finally, you're going to learn something from listening to the podcast, and it's about time. My guest is historian Douglas Boyne, and his big area of expertise is ancient Rome. And he's written this wonderful book, Alaric the Goth, An Outsider's History of the Fall of Rome. And this Alaric the Goth led the sack of Rome in 410 AD. He's the guy who brought down the Holy Roman Empire, barbarians at the gate, Alaric led them. And the whole reason I interviewed him was that there are just tremendous parallels between Rome in 410 AD and the United States in 2020 AD, including that the emperor at the time had ridiculous hair. So before we get to Alaric the Goth, let's talk about Donald Trump for a second. Holy mackerel, just when you think you couldn't possibly learn something worse than you already know about Donald Trump as a human being, we get this Atlantic Monthly story about his contempt for the suckers who've served in our military and were wounded or died for our country. Losers. Now, you've probably heard this hashed out by now, but, not going to the cemetery in France where over 1,000 Marines died in World War I, stopping the Germans' advance on Paris. According to the article, Trump didn't go because it was raining and he was afraid that his hair would collapse. Maybe that's the best word. Anyway, that's, of course, why he didn't go. But to save face, he told his aides he didn't want to go because it's a cemetery filled with losers. To save face. And by the way, there is no way he didn't say this stuff, because one of the absolutely horrendous stories in the piece is him going to Arlington Cemetery with John Kelly, visiting Kelly's son's grave and saying, "I don't get what was in it for them." And in the article says, Kelly, who declined to comment for this story, initially believed, people close to him said, that Trump was making a ham-handed reference to the selflessness of America's all-volunteer force. But later, he came to realize that Trump simply does not understand non-transactional life choices. So I called up my old colleague, Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth. You probably know that the chopper that Tammy was piloting in Iraq was shot down, and she lost both her legs. So here's our phone call. Thanks for calling in.
Of course.
Now, at the end of this Atlantic Monthly piece, the author writes that during planning for a military parade, Trump asked his staff to not include wounded veterans on the grounds that spectators would feel uncomfortable in the presence of amputees. Nobody wants to see that, he said. Now, as a double amputee, I'm sure you've been getting twice the requests that mere single amputees have been getting. Is that right today for interviews?
Yes, we go by the body part.
Now, I know you pretty well, and you have a good dark sense of humor, as do I. But this one sickens me. This just sickens me. And we know it's true because Kelly hasn't denied it. Part of the article is that he goes to Arlington and goes to the grave with Kelly of his son and says, he's a sucker. Why would he do this?
Yeah. He also said that Mattis was a pretty smart guy. I wonder why he joined the military. Also, this is consistent with what Trump has said all along. He has no respect for those who serve a cause greater than themselves, and he views them as suckers. And it's shameful in somebody who is sitting in the position of being the commander-in-chief of our nation's military.
Well,
of the bravest men and women that both you and I have ever met.
Of course. I mean,
he commands them.
He's the commander-in-chief. I would think this might be a little demoralizing for the men and women of the military to know that the commander-in-chief is calling them suckers and losers.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's demoralizing. But even if you did not care about the troops, it also affects our military readiness. Because when our troops go into harm's way, they need to know that the nation and their entire command is 100% behind them. They should not have even a moment of doubt that if I get wounded, will I be cared for? Will my family be cared for? They need to focus purely on the mission at hand. And how can they do that when the commander-in-chief calls them suckers and questions their sacrifices? And by the way, hasn't done enough by them when it comes to veterans' benefits in the 4 years that he's been in office.
Now, I did not serve, as you know, but I did do a lot of USO tours, and that's how we met. We met Walter Reed.
Yes. We met at Walter Reed, and you did the USO tours, not just to Walter Reed. You went overseas multiple times as well. And I will tell you that we troops really, really valued those who came on the USO tours because you didn't have to go, right? You were not under orders. You volunteered to go into a war zone. You volunteered to go into some of the most heart-wrenching situations at Walter Reed on your own will because you cared about us. And our troops, me being one of them, will always, always hold that dear in our heart. And just, you know, we have a special place in our heart for USO tour members. I was already an Al Franken fan before you came through.
So well, when we
you
met,
went you went over a new fan in me. But yeah,
when we met. Was it Rush Limbaugh's Big Fat Idiot or was it Lies and Lying Liars on your bedside table?
I had been reading Lies and Lying Liars in Iraq. And when you get wounded and they send all your gear back, or if you get killed, God forbid, they send all your gear back. And they just send the basic, you know, most personal things. And I didn't get my book back. and I was bitching about it to you. And then 2 weeks after you visited, you very kindly sent me an autographed copy, which I have prominently displayed on my bookshelf here at home.
Well, meeting you and also going, you know, to Walter Reed was an amazingly moving experience for me, always. And I remember the first guy I met had a leg missing. He was leaning against the wall. I said, "What happened to you?" And he said, "Well, I came in here for a vasectomy," and the sense of humor of these guys. And when I first started there, I don't remember. We've probably discussed all this, but you know, we'd take a picture and then I'd sign it, right? And I would sign. You know, first I would say thank you for your service, and about the third guy I signed it for, he said, "You know, we really don't like that because everybody just says thank you for your service and we don't know how much they really mean it."
Right.
So I kept, then I started doing signing pictures. Thank you for being grievously wounded.
And we loved it.
Of course. Awesome. Of course.
I do chuckle about it.
So there you go. there's not much more to say. Pretty disgusting. Do you think this could be it? I mean, I know when he said that, you know, when he kind of very early in the campaign said that McCain wasn't a hero because, you know, he doesn't really think people got captured were heroes. And when that didn't do it, I thought that was the end of his campaign. And when it wasn't, and between then and now, there's been a million things. I mean, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me a million times, shame on me. But could this be it? Could this be it? No, right?
Well, I would tell you, though, Al, there was a poll that came out that shows that the majority of actively serving men and women have said that they would not vote for him. He's gotten to that point now where the majority of those who serve would not vote for him. And I think this is sort of, you know, this puts a cap on it. I don't think that if there were any that were undecided that they will vote for him now. And you're right. It is in a long series of things that he said. Remember that when somebody showed him their Purple Heart, he said, oh, I'd love one of those. I'd like getting it this way, the easy way. Somebody just gives it to you.
That could have been a joke. It could have been, you know.
Yeah, but it's not something to joke about.
I know, but that doesn't, it could have been slightly inappropriate joke. He could maybe not have meant literally that, maybe. You know, when I would go, I did 7 USO tours. And when I go to a DFAC, a dining facility, there was, Fox was on. And these guys were, men and women, were pretty, you know, right-wing and pretty conservative. And the fact that that a plurality of them, I think it was a plurality, don't support him and is pretty amazing. So, Tammy, thank you.
My pleasure to be on.
And thank you for your service. And thank you for saying what you did in the New Yorker piece. I appreciate that.
Well, of course. I just tell it like it is, Al.
Okay. We'll get back to work. Stay safe and don't lose any more legs, okay?
Well, the ones I can lose now are great. They're easy to replace.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Tammy.
Okay, thanks, Al. Bye.
We'll be right back with Douglas Boyne and Alaric the Goth. The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel's convenient courses have helped me learn real-life conversation in German. For example, let's say you wanted to order soup with your dinner. Die Suppe würde mir auch gefallen. That means the soup. That means I would also like the soup. And that way, I get soup with dinner. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/franken. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/franken, spelled babbel.com/franken. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I read the book. Sounds like you did some research for this.
A little bit. Four years.
Yeah. The reason I'm interviewing you now is that there are some parallels. Alaric is the guy who led the sack of Rome. That's considered sort of the sack.
That's right. Yep.
The most important sack, or the turning point. It was the first sack, right?
It was. It was the first time in maybe 800 years, so not in anyone's immediate memory, that the empire had seen someone attack its capital city. So really kind of catastrophic moment.
Okay. And then after that, Rome was kind of never the same, at least that part of the empire, the
that's right.
European yeah, that's right. part. Constantinople had a kind of a life after that for a long time. That empire stood for quite a while, right?
It did. The empire in the East is often kind of held up and cheerleaded as this kind of shining example of how you can continue after a major attack on one half of your empire. But I think that's, you know, it's really tricky to try to get any good news out of that. The empire completely fell apart after Alaric's attack. The empire wasn't anywhere nearly as cohesive or united as it was. So the idea that, you know, you can look to Constantinople and say, hey, you know, we kept it going for as long as we did, I have real problems with, because, you know, in order to get there, they basically had to say, well, we're not going to incorporate foreigners. We're not going to find a way to build an inclusive empire. So we'll just do our thing and continue to call it ancient Rome. And they lasted, but I mean, it was nowhere near the phenomenon that the Roman Empire was before that.
Now, you talked about 800 years before Alaric, there was maybe another sacking, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm thinking? I think we should start off, because just as this is a service to my listeners and frankly to me, which is I don't know my history of Rome. And I would love to be able to go to a cocktail party and start talking about this as if I knew what I was talking about. And I think so to all my listeners. And then they'd be able to work it into a conversation.
I don't know if I have it broken down that easily. All I know is that I'm really good at cocktail parties.
I went to college and I went through high school, and I don't know anything about Rome other than it was there a long time and then it wasn't there or something. Uh-huh. So could you just tell me here at this cocktail party, what's the deal? What was the deal with Rome?
The deal with Rome is really just a society that I don't think you'd ever want to step foot in today. It's a society of slavery. It's totally unjust. It's, you know, extraordinarily unequal in terms of wealth and access to power and education. And 10% of the population is literate. It is not anything that should be held up as...
Wait a minute. A lot of those things do describe us today.
We're talking about Rome here. I mean, this is, you know, so this is my 2-minute pitch on Rome. But okay. It managed a phenomenal amount of accomplishment in its more than 1,000-year history. I mean, it started small, started as a little village town in the center of Italy by two kids, mythologically, who were raised by a wolf. It grew up through a sequence of governments, from a monarchy to a republic to something that was a little more similar to a monarchy again. But during that time, it went from tiny little village to something that, if we had to put it on the map, probably encompasses maybe, I think, 50, 52 modern nations on 3 continents. So all of the languages of those continents, all of the customs and cultures that went with those people all became a part of this civilization that produced plays, fought wars, engineered amazing monuments. And I think it's probably right that if we are looking through the history books and flipping through the history books, trying to think, you know, who came before us? Are we really the first people to try to solve the problems that we're solving? That Rome would stand out and that we would want to go back and learn more about it.
Okay. So the Alaric fits in here where you say it's over 1,000 years. So Alaric is 410 AD. Right, is the sack of Rome. And he was a Goth, and he was a soldier. He had been a military guy. He was born not in Rome, but across the Danube from Rome, which was sort of a demarcation. And Goths were not considered Romans, right?
That's right. They were the northern frontier. They were the people just outside the border. The river was the border, and they grew up on the other side. So their own sets of customs, their own villages. They'd lived on the land for at least 100 or so years before Alaric's time. So you can imagine them kind of being kind of the native residents and just always looking over their shoulder at who are these kind of blustery imperialists that are just south of us. That was kind of the world he grew up in.
I'm going to quote Socrates here, as I'm wont to do. The horror of 410 stemmed from the casual disregard and complete inattention to the situation between citizens and foreigners, you see. And so I quote that for a couple reasons. One, it sounds like I know about Socrates and can quote him. But two, it seems to me that there are some parallels here. And I'm going to read another, then I'm going to quote you.
Okay.
This was an age of extremism, a time when moderates everywhere lost political ground and radical beliefs about religious identity, state borders, and cultural exchange polluted the air, spreading across 3 continents. The political, cultural, and social disintegration of the Roman Empire might have been shocking, but not wholly surprising to those of Alaric's age. Their generation had witnessed dysfunction, disunity, their entire lives, and one of the most divisive issues was the question of citizenship and whether foreigners would have a fair shot at becoming Romans. Okay, the reason I quoted that is that there are a lot of parallels here. Was that deliberate when you wrote that?
I wrote this book predominantly to make sure that we had an outsider's perspective on a usual set of events. You know, and I've written the textbook, basically, for all intents and purposes, on this period. So, you know, I'm not out there trying to make a cheap sell. I'm not out there trying to cash in on an easy, quick comparison. But having said that, and having listened to...
And where can you buy this book?
You can buy it wherever books are sold.
Okay, good.
Having listened to you just kind of summarize that prose part, all of that was in my mind. I wake up, I read the newspaper. I can't get out of the frustration of the present day. And every bone in my body wants me to be engaged, however it is that I can be engaged. So when I was looking at this landscape of Alaric's time, I just knew that there was something there that other people might be interested in, because it was just eerie in terms of the overlaps and the resonances.
Well, let's go into that, because Alaric is a Goth, okay? And I think most people know that Goths were considered barbarians, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, we don't necessarily use that word anymore, but yes.
Well, I don't want to offend any Goths out there. Okay, but what I'm saying is, when people think of barbarians at the gate, this is kind of literally it, right?
They invaded and
sacked Rome. So can you tell me who Vandals are and who Goths are and any of the other peoples that were considered barbarians when that was a proper term?
Yeah, you've got Huns. So they're kind of, you know, team leader is, for all intents and purposes, Attila. The Hun is someone who stands out as a leader of one of these groups of people who we call barbarians. The Vandals don't really have a big standout leader, but came from northern Central Europe and eventually sacked and pillaged all their way to North Africa, acquired a really bad, you know, pejorative reputation through...
They tipped over like people's mailboxes, right?
Exactly.
And TP'd their lawns.
St. Augustine's mail was constantly being held up by Vandals. And then the Goths. And there's a host of others. But for, you know, if you're trying to conceptualize who they are and why they're called barbarians, they were outside the borders of the Roman Empire. And because of the just ingrained cultural superiority that the Roman people just really kind of couldn't kick, they could never get rid of the sense that, you know, if you didn't speak Latin or Greek, if you didn't kind of behave or dress the way that we did in our sophisticated culture, that you didn't deserve the name of being civilized. And so really, when you think about the whole globe outside of the Mediterranean, which is really just an olive-driven, you know, water-centric empire, as soon as you leave that, then you get to global history, but you get Romans who don't want to have anything to do with people who are outside that realm. So my kind of inclination as a storyteller is always to look for the untold perspective, or to just kind of flip the tables or the script on the way things are usually told. And so I was looking at this kind of map of the world and thinking, like, you could tell the story of Rome again and when what happened to it and stay within that isolated universe, or why not build a bridge to the direction that the globe is taking, which is to more kind of wider, expansive understanding of who people are, their traditions are, and try and find that person who literally grew up in between everything. And to me, Alaric was the person who just called out to have his story told, because he was kind of on the fence, literally, between two parts of the globe.
Basically, in the book, you talk about his story, and he was a warrior in the Roman army. Right. And he was very impressed, very good at it, and was sort of taken under the wing of Romans, and he was, wasn't he administrator in one of the cities? He became part of the Roman government, right?
Exactly. I mean, the Romans are impressed, even in their kind of haughtiness and in their sense of cultural superiority. They were always impressed with how he acted and behaved. And that is a kind of double-edged sword. But they would always say, and they were clear about it, that he was more Roman than he was a Goth. And I think that's a kind of not necessarily a compliment if we really, really analyze it. But they liked him. And he clearly had this inclination as a young kid to try to make a name for himself or a place for himself inside Rome. And I think what the sources suggest is that lots of people did. They saw Rome as something that was welcoming. They saw it as a place where you could get a farm, have a trade, provide for your family. And the requirements for what you needed to do were often really, really minimal to make that happen.
What you describe in terms of the bias against Goths, that kind of, this is over 1,000 years. So there are different periods there. I mean, the United States has been around 400 years, I guess, basically. And we go through different cycles pretty fast. And they did too. At certain points, Goths were more welcome than at other times. And didn't a Goth become emperor?
So there is a really famous story of he's probably descended from a Gothic dad, and his mom is also a kind of border parent. But in the 3rd century, he was one of the first people to take advantage of a new citizenship law, and he became emperor. And the Goths themselves told that story. People from Alaric's day loved that story because it kind of spoke to the triumphs, the successes. I mean, yeah, these were, you know, not everything was kind of gloom and doom. There were paths to potential.
No, well, that is actually also a little bit of a parallel here, which is we go through periods too. I feel like we're going through a bad period right now in many ways. But things change in 1,000 years. And for example, oh, Jesus happened, right? And by the way, since you're a scholar on Rome, I just want to make this clear. It was the Romans who killed Christ and not the Jews, right?
100% right. You're 100% right.
That's right. So I want everyone listening to understand that the Romans killed Jesus and not the Jews, not the Jews. We'll be right back with Douglas Boyne and Alaric the Barbarian.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Welcome back. We're talking about Alaric the Goth. And now I have another question, because I've seen a few movies where Pontius Pilate shows up. And a couple times I've seen movies with him, he says something, and he says it this way, bring me this king of the Jews that I might meet him. Did Pontius Pilate talk that way? It was very stilted, I thought.
Yeah, everything that we know from Jesus' death an execution comes to us secondhand and through the bias of people who believed in him. I mean, notwithstanding my 21 years of Catholic education, I tend to kind of take a little bit more of a historical appreciation for some of these things now. And I mean, it's very unlikely that he even probably could have picked, you know, Jesus out of a lineup, as it were, simply because when you hear news of a rabble rouser, or you hear news of someone kind of stirring up commotion in the temple or in your territory, you simply just round everyone up and crucify them. So these elaborate set pieces, these elaborate scenes of, you know, dramatic play acting, as it were, I just think you have to be really suspicious about any of it.
Well, you got to take license. You got to make the movie interesting.
Yeah.
We know that.
Yeah.
But that brings me to, okay, that's the beginning of Christianity. So that was a big deal. And Christianity was outlawed in the Holy Roman Empire. Well, it wasn't holy then, I guess, the Roman Empire. And then it became mandatory at a certain point, right?
It did.
Then it switched back to not. So again, things are in flux during this period. And of course, Jesus was, I think he was born 0 AD.
If you ask the medieval monks, they made sure to reorient the calendar, to restart everything at 0. If you asked the scholars, they would probably say the time telling is off, and we probably would say 4 BC. So it's almost kind of ridiculous. Jesus was born before Jesus was born, but that's kind of the way that the calendar has gotten out of sync from over the course of 1,000 years.
So he was 4 when 0 happened, but okay.
Correct, yeah.
He was born BC, so before Christ, he was born.
Right.
Okay, so that's enough for an entire podcast, but let's not do that. Okay, so the point is that things change, and at one point being Christian was like outlawed. And by the way, you're talking about Pontius Pilate crucifying people. Reading your book, I was just impressed at how friggin' brutal and violent life was, especially for emperors. It seemed like every emperor, not everyone, but a lot of them died and were assassinated, mm-hmm. and a number beheaded. A number of them ended up on their head, ended up on a spike, a salted head. Was that what you?
Yeah, you nailed it. Yeah. You know, this book was about violence at every facet of society. I mean, we see the heads on the spikes and the salted skulls and the people who get spears in their eye sockets. And that was
during a battle.
Yeah.
So that was, you described that where it was a Roman soldier in battle.
Yep. Yep.
Gets a, what's, is that like, it's not a spear. What would you call that?
It was a javelin, I think.
A javelin. Goes through, I mean, you have your helmet, your metal mask and helmet, right? Is that what you have then?
Yep.
Yeah. But you got to see, so you have an eye hole. And he got a javelin in his eye, but kept fighting.
Yeah, there was one who got it right at the base of his neck, and he came back home and kept, you know, literally kept going. It's one of the, you know, the violence is at every level of society, and so the emperors are the ones who, you know, there's machinations, there's imperial assassinations and plots. And then you've got the kind of everyday folks like the Alaric and the Goths and the Vandals, who there might be a burned church one day where their worship center gets set on fire because there's this kind of rabid xenophobic zeitgeist swirling around. And then all of the violence that we just never see, the kind of, you know, daily interactions of doors shut in people's faces, or I mean, one of the ones that I just really always stood out to me, it's just a little vignette, was the guys, the Goths, who would be just out on the road coming back from the market or something, and they would meet Roman soldiers, and the Roman soldiers would say, "Hey, why don't you come join us at the tavern? Why don't you come, you know, we'll go have dinner together?" And they would never come home. They would never make it home because they were literally kind of beaten up, fallen upon, murdered, kicked to the side of the road. This was an ugly time.
And speaking of ugly, they were slaves, right?
Yeah. And gladiators. Arbitrary slaves. I mean, I actually just did, this was really, it was really coincidental. Right before the book came out, one of my old students had reached out to me, and she teaches sixth grade in Chicago. And I had grown up in Chicago, and she was one of my students, and it was getting to be the end of the year. Everyone had been Zooming lessons. Everyone was exhausted. And she said, would you mind putting a lesson together to talk to the sixth graders about ancient Rome? Because we're doing our ancient unit, and they would just love it. They would love to meet it. So I got all excited and, you know, I put something together, tried to be as harmless and innocuous and down to earth as possible. Like, you know, whatever the sixth grade equivalent of a happy hour is, I'm not sure what that is. But
it's a graham crackers,
graham cracker event. So I put something together on animals, and I put something together on, you know, just geography and volcanoes, because I thought that would be up their alley. And wouldn't you know it? I mean, at the end of the talk, a little girl raises her hand in Zoom and says, was there racial discrimination in ancient Rome? And I just remember just having this really contradictory feeling in me of what a profoundly smart girl, what an amazing moment for her to ask that. I mean, this took place four weeks ago, but then also what a horrible world we're currently going through right now, where that's where we have to talk about these things. So the world is ugly. Rome was ugly, but I think it has to be talked about.
Again, you know, who was a foreigner? Who got citizenship was a big part of what led to the sacking of Rome. Let's talk about the sacking in particular. So they have gates, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Romans had a lot of security. They thought they had secured Rome. Tell us about the gates of Rome.
The gates are these kind of imposing passageways that are your arrival and the way that you kind of say goodbye. So you've got these just huge, gigantic kind of mouths with portcullises, which is the kind of technical term for the metal grates that come down and keep carriages out. These kind of huge maws that you go in and out, and there's signs of life when you see them from 20 miles away, you know, 10 miles away. You know that you've arrived in a place like Rome. So there are some big ones around the city. There's four really big ones. There's kind of middle range gates that would allow maybe just one cart or chariot to make its way in and out. And then you've got kind of the smaller gates that are really just no more than a wooden door that someone comes at the end of the night and shuts up and locks. And so all around the city, you've got this series of 16 gates in Alaric's day that are protected by the army. And they, you know, it's their job to make sure that they keep an eye out on who's coming and who's going. So that's kind of like the defensive world that we're talking about.
In 410, this is the sack lasted 3 days.
It started on the 24th, and by the 28th, the Goths were on their way to southern Italy. So about 3 days, yeah.
24th of what month?
Of August.
So August 24th of 410. How do they get in the gate?
So there's contradictory sources. One is that he just does about a month of reconnaissance and figures out kind of strategically where the best place is, where the soldiers might, you know, fall asleep early, where there might be a chance to sneak in and, you know, take advantage of people's, the lull in people's routine. And the other option, the other source, which comes from slightly later, but is no less fascinating, is that he had help, and that there was a wealthy woman whose name is Proba, and that she actually leaves in the middle of the night to open one of the doors for him so that he can easily then slip inside. Whichever one it was, I think is not necessarily. I mean, I would love to work it out. History is about working things out. I would absolutely love to know. But I think they both suggest something really fascinating, which is this was a subtle moment. It wasn't kind of as, you know, there wasn't a kind of, well, just, a, you know.
It wasn't charging like a horde of soldiers charging a gate and breaking it down. He was a military strategist.
He was a thinker. Yeah. I mean, he had been in battle. He had been studying the manuals. He had known how to devise and design and be strategic. So I think either way, there was just a sense of the impression I get from him, having collected all the pieces of his life as I did, is that he was just very clever. I got the impression that he was clever.
And the Romans, you know, they conquered a large part of the world and with their army, and they taught their soldiers a lot of military strategy, and part of that was reconnaissance, right?
Totally. I mean, everything he learned about how to predict what could happen if you tried to charge a gate. You might get flaming wooden wheels thrown on you that would roll down into your horses if you weren't careful. Everything he knew about the walls being deceptively double layered. I mean, from the outside, it looks like there's just one circuit of walls, but every Roman military engineer knows that your best defense is to set up a parallel wall right behind it. So when people break through, surprise, you know, you have another wall, and then you get slaughtered while you tackle it. Everything he knew about how Rome worked, Rome taught him because he was a Roman soldier.
Do they indiscriminately kill Romans or not?
I think we have to say yes. I think when people are let loose, that idea of coming into a city at night and being let loose and being angry, we may not have the exact sources to tell us who died or how many died or how many people took part in the riots. But there were women who were taken from their home. There were people who lost their lives, maybe not in those 72 hours, but slightly after them because of the trauma or because of the attack. At one point, it becomes clear to Alaric that there is this indiscriminate killing, and he does put a stop to it. There is a source that says when he found out how poorly people were being treated by the Goths who had come in with him, he's very clear about saying, this is not who I want us to be. This is not what this is about. So make sure if people are going to churches, treat that as a sanctuary space. Treat them as people who are getting asylum. Don't, you know, indiscriminately slaughter. But I think during those first moments, the impression clearly is there was just a lot of rage, and it got directed in ways that were uncontrolled.
Let's go then back to the source of the rage. That is that the prejudice against Goths and other foreigners, and sort of the rules about who's a Roman and who isn't.
There were really kind of unfair thing that always kind of struck me in a really unfair way was just the unwritten rules that the Romans came up with for who counted or who mattered. They had a system for extending citizenship. It was basically decree. It was, you know, the emperor says, you have citizenship. It's really as simple as that. But the everyday experiences of foreigners who came into the empire had to deal with this unwritten kind of set of laws that you had to dress a proper way. I mean, the people of the borders of the Roman Empire, the barbarians, you know, they don't wear togas traditionally. You know, they're not necessarily dressed in their sparkling white business outfit that a senator would be dressed in, or even necessarily in a kind of tunic, which is a kind of colorful or everyday outfit that you would have if you just were doing errands or working around at home. They dressed, you know, they had furs, they had animal skins, they had pants, they had leather. This was not anything that a Roman was kind of taught to accept. Then you throw on the fact that they might speak a foreign language, they might speak Latin or communicate with you in a stumbling way. They might not be the strongest you know, native fluent speaker. And so the accents, the way that they dressed, how they behaved, these were all things that the Romans used to not give them rights. And I think that was just, that jumped out to me.
Well, I mean, so in other words, you're goth and you're walking around Rome and you're wearing some furs and you got this big beard and you have some tattoos and Romans like look at you and go like, "Hey, man, what are you doing here?" And then the goth would go like, "This is my place."
Exactly.
You know, this is your, you know, and then another goth tells that goth, "You shouldn't have to even say that. That you don't owe that to the Roman. You don't have to tell him it's your place." That's sort of what's happening in Rome at the time.
Yeah, that and what's remarkable. I mean, it sounds like the way that hearing you describe it, the way you kind of like, you know, bring it back to life. It just sounds to me like it could be taking place at a coffee shop or taking place, you know, out in the streets right now. I mean, you just have captured how complicated it is. The one thing from the sources that is just so, so amazing to find, you know, when you find those moments that you can document and point to that just speak to you, you just have this aha moment. And I remember one of the aha moments was this little fragment of a story of two Goths, just like you kind of imagine, two Goths at a dinner party. They had been invited to the palace. It was the emperor's dinner party. They were trying to be nice guests. And there's a lot of wine. Everyone's having a good time. And the two of them get into a fight. They get into a political fight at the dinner party. The substance of the conversation.
With each other?
With each other. They're sitting okay. Over there on one corner of the room. And they're just, they're kind of devolving. Their internal chat is just kind of devolving. Because one of them is saying, "Shouldn't we be grateful that the Romans have invited us here and that they seem to be kind of slowly coming around to accepting Goths in the kind of larger framework of society?" And the other one is there saying, "I'm losing my patience with how slowly this process is going. I'm not sure we need to be grateful for the scraps of acceptance and legal acceptance that they're giving us. Something needs to change. It needs to change kind of fast." The way the story resolves is the two Goths are just overcome with alcohol and one murders the other. And there's just this kind of bloodbath at the state dinner party that the emperor has to kind of have the enslaved people come and clean up and leave.
You know, then were Goths not invited then?
It's one of the last kind of examples we have of Goths being invited to an imperial dinner party. But just the conversation between the two of them is right on target with what you were saying. They knew that what they were trying to get was a big ask. And there was a political debate within them about how effectively to get it, how quickly to get it. And they were impatient with each other and they were at odds with each other about how to do it.
Let me ask you about that, because there's so much scholarship in this book. And so I was very curious about how you do that. What exists? It seems like you had to work very hard to put the fragments together. And what does exist? What's written and what isn't written? And what's written later, like a century later? How do you research this thing?
You know, if you wanted to kind of get the story of what was happening right when Alaric was born, fortunately, everyone in Rome was reading Ammianus. He's like your go-to reporter for kind of everything that happened in the 4th century. Thankfully, we have big chunks of his work. It was a magnum opus, and it still is in the library shelves. I mean, it's, you know, it tells us about sports. It tells us about military campaigns against Persia, like really detailed, substantial reporting. By the time Alaric comes into the Roman Empire, so maybe by the time he's like in his 20s or early 20s, Ammianus has died. And that means, as historians, we're kind of screwed. Except there were two writers, one's named Olympiodorus and one's named Eunapius, who took up the mantle of wanting to kind of be that on the ground hotshot historical voice. And they wrote everything. They went everywhere. They traveled. They interviewed. They sat in taverns. Olympiodorus had a pet parrot that he took with him. And, you know, he would sit at the tavern and people would have the parrot do tricks. And Olympiodorus would go home and, you know, write everything down that he was researching. And fortunately, those two writers were written down and copied and preserved into the Middle Ages. So we have parts of what it is that they said, even though their texts, the big kind of like blockbusters that they wrote, don't survive in full. So it's almost kind of the further you go into Alaric's life, the less material you get, which is always just really maddening as a historian. You kind of want full pictures. So a little bit of big, you know, Ammianus, then you got the scraps of the writers, and then you've got the archaeologists who are there digging up new information. So it was really a combination of all those three sources that I needed.
And where do you go to do that research? Do you go to libraries here? Do you go to Rome? What do you do?
I will always use an opportunity to go to Rome. So that was, you know, the libraries in Rome are fantastic, both because they have the ancient sources in the forms that we need them, but the scholarship that goes along with them. I mean, you can imagine people have been writing about this stuff for generations. And one of the kind of tricks of being able to do it is that, you know, you can jump in and just play with the ancient sources and kind of put them into a rough shape. But as a scholar, I think it's also really important to take account of what people have said around and about those sources. So the whole tradition, I mean, we're talking multiple languages here, you know, the tradition in French, the tradition in German, the tradition in Italian of what we know has been said before. As the scholar, I have to be up on all of that case law, as it were. So really, if I can find a good research library, Rome has a really good research library, then I can do all that work at one time. And that's kind of how I get stuff done.
I know that Trump is a bit of a scholar of Rome, and he said a lot of that is fake news.
Uh-huh, yeah. I mean, you'll find scholars who are equally adamant that the reports, let's say, if something is only attested for Alaric's life in one source, you'll get scholars who are just absolutely certain that it's fake, you know, just because it's said once. And I get that inclination. I mean, I am a skeptic. I am totally critical, hypercritical at times. But I also think when trying to make, you know, a big audience understand why something matters, you can do both things. You can say, treat this with suspicion.
Yeah, you do that in the book. You do that a lot. You go like, okay, this is what is said, but we don't know, right?
I think honesty is the best policy, right? I mean, I want to create trust with the person reading the book. So I just want to be honest about where things are coming from. The degree of difficulty for this project was absurd. I mean, there's a reason why the last book on Alaric was a novel written in France in the 1930s. It was, you know, an amazing opportunity to just, you know, pretend Alaric was, you know, a fin de siècle barbarian, seeing shows in Athens and enjoying the good life. I mean, it's almost been impossible to try to do something. So this is really a story of his time. And I just hope people get that.
You know, I don't normally read nonfiction or fiction about Rome, ancient Rome, but this was very, very eye-opening. And again, the parallels to now in terms of the xenophobia, calling others the other, characterizing that way, the extreme the loss of the middle at that time, very, very parallel in so many ways, you know, concerns me because we obviously, the United States has always, or has since World War II, in many ways been the indispensable nation. And as recently as the Ebola crisis, we led in that. The CDC led in that, the response to that. We are, And part of this, I think, has to do with our president. You have seen a collapse, really, of our government in terms of being able to do stuff and wanting to do stuff. And you've also seen a guy who wants to divide us. It's obviously concerning to everybody. We used to be the indispensable nation. He has pulled back. This president has seems to embrace dictators and thugs. He abandons, you know, allies who have died for us, the Kurds. We are losing our place in the world, and I'm very concerned right now. There's polling that has Biden ahead of Trump, but many a slip twixt cup and lip, and this guy is very good at dividing people, and this might be that kind of election.
Societies are given these moments. Rome was given this moment to decide whether it wanted to change its ways after Alaric's attack. It chose not to change its ways, and then the Roman Empire fell apart. So I think the moments we see in history are not inevitable times of collapse. What we really can get out of them is, what are the forces that are making people think we should just keep going with the way that we're going and kind of blithely oblivious to the consequences.
I noticed you, I think the third chapter, you started with a quote from Euripides, the playwright, right? He was a playwright.
Yep, yep.
And he says, "It's slow speech that brings the greatest wisdom." And I've been criticized for speaking too slowly. I just want to say that Euripides was right on the mark.
I mean, I like that quote very much because my mind sometimes moves too fast. And I have to kind of constantly, my partner is the one actually always telling me, he's saying, just slow down, just be more thoughtful. And I think that's why I like writing, because I have to go slow when I write. And so I just think that's, it captured the idea of what it meant to grow up, what it meant to mature. So that was why I put it there.
Well, I thank you for this book. I thank you for joining me. Any kind of perspective that I can try to give by talking to authors like you, scholars like you, just thinkers like you, I think is helpful to my listeners, and I thank you for your work.
This has been super. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Al Franken podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding right your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.